Okay. All right, then, as you are getting comfortable there, counsel, I will call the case. This is the second case on our oral argument calendar today, and I apologize if I mispronounce any names. You can correct me, perhaps, during the course of your argument. The case is A23-0331, Ellen Sue Loss-Ewald et al., petitioners appellants, versus Nina Loss-Ewald, Ndrebo respondent. And I just have a few words for you before we hand you the reins this morning. Appellant will have a 15-minute argument, respondent will have a 15-minute argument, and then appellant will have the opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal argument. You'll be making your arguments from the podium here in the center, which is adjustable. I know counsel for appellant was here when I said it, but I'm going to say it again for your benefit, counsel for respondent. We are live streaming the arguments this morning, and we are also making an audio recording of your arguments. For the benefit of that audio recording, I just ask that you please identify yourself and the party you're representing before you begin making your argument. With that, I will turn things over to you, counsel for appellant. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Gary Diebele. I represent the appellants in this case, Ellen Ewald and Terry McCallison, who are the maternal grandparents of the subject child, and Ms. Ewald is the mother of the respondent, Nina Ndrebo. I'm gonna just start very briefly, Your Honor, with a little bit of factual background and the briefest background on the procedural history before I get into, basically I've got three legal issues I'm going to address today. The first two are statutory construction issues, which the de novo standard of review would apply. The third issue is a sufficiency of the evidence, kind of an argument that the clearly erroneous standard would apply. But this case has got a long and complicated history, and indeed my clients have struggled with parenting their daughter since she was a child. She had serious mental health and behavioral issues kind of all of her childhood. Things sort of reached a head when she went off to college, went to Mount Holyoke in Massachusetts. She was born in Norway. My client, Ms. Ewald, is an American citizen, and her husband is a Norwegian citizen. And the child is dual citizenship, Norwegian and U.S. And basically what happened, behavioral issues became such when she was in college, they started to look for diagnoses. One of the working diagnoses was bipolar. And there were also some eating disorders and other just kind of challenging, difficult behavior. Long resistance by the mother to accepting these diagnoses and to changing her behavior. We reached another milestone in the case when, after college, Ms. Ndrebo sort of disappeared, cut herself off from family for 5 or 6 years, and then surfaced in Norway, pregnant, which she didn't know about until late into the pregnancy, and gave birth to this child. The subject child. Norwegian Child Protection intervened and removed the child from her care. She then reestablished contact with her mother and stepfather, and I think her biological father, Ms. Ewald's first husband, was in Norway as well. My clients intervened. They flew over to Norway to help. They challenged the child protection process, and through much struggle and difficulty, were able to secure the release of the child to them, to the three, to the mother and the maternal grandparents, over the strong objections of child protection. But the court, in a litigation process, said, yes, we're gonna let this child go. Otherwise, the child would have been adopted out to a Norwegian family. That was the plan with child protection. So child was born in January of 2016, and by the end of 2016, my clients and Ms. Ndrebo and the child all moved to Minnesota. And they resided together until August of 2019. And as a result, Ms. Ewald in particular, although Mr. McCallison was heavily involved too, really co-parented and raised this child. In fact, probably were more parenting than the mother was doing. She was in school at the time going back for a graduate degree and preoccupied with that, plus dealing with complicated mental health issues. And what happened is there was always sort of a difficult relationship between mother and daughter, and these mental health issues exacerbated this. And what happens...
Could I interrupt you? Would it be safe to say, because we're familiar with the facts tonight, and it, would it be safe to say that your first two issues really drive your appeal here, because it looks like the district court, those findings kind of summarize everything that you're indicating here. So
right.
It's fair. Is it fair to say the information that kind of led up to the most recent ruling was all before the district court?
Yes, I think that's a safe assumption. And I'll just flag one thing for the court. I did reference in my brief, there is a very detailed psychiatric evaluation by our expert, and it's Exhibit 13. So if you're looking for more details on this long history, that's, in my view, the best process. So what happens is what triggers this, and I think this is important because we're going to get to the relocation statute in a minute, is after Ms. Nereba moves out of her mother and stepfather's home and onto her own, she announced that she wanted to move out east with the child. And this was during the start of the pandemic. So this case really gets started from a legal standpoint in March of 2020. And we filed a petition for custody because we wanted to stop this move to Western Massachusetts, where she had no support network, and my clients were quite concerned that she's never parented this child. I don't know, what do we do? So we have this trial that you referenced, Judge Sleater, that culminates. It was a 5-day trial in October of 2021. And Judge Conley issues his order. And I'm going to bring this up because Judge Sullivan, who subsequently replaced Judge Connolly when he left the family court bench in Hennepin County, disagrees with my interpretation of this, of Judge Conley's order. But the first thing that Judge Conley did was he did not allow the child to move. He said, Mom, you can go wherever you want, but child stays in Minnesota. And so then we begin a year and a half of litigation, discovery, evaluations, the whole bit. Culminates in this trial where Judge Conley then issues his final order. He denied the request for custody by my clients, but he issued a very robust grandparent visitation order under 257C.08. It was almost, you know, pretty significant parenting time, holidays, 2 weeks in the summer, and a 24-hour right of first refusal, which I've never seen in a third-party visitation order before. So my take on that order was that Judge Conley's intent was to really provide and ratify Ms. Ewald's request for a safety net. She wanted to be there to help parent this child and deal with any of Mom's mental health issues. So that order is issued in November 11th of 2021, and my clients did not appeal. They were reasonably happy with the order. They didn't get custody, but they got the, you know, Ms. Ewald was very well established at that time and settled into a good job, good school for the child, good mental health care for herself and the child, and my clients had this robust visitation schedule. Ms. Nedrabo then filed a motion for amended findings or a new trial in January of 22, subsequently decided not to pursue that, and then out of the blue, we get a letter from her new attorney, who was not the trial attorney, say, oh, Mr. Drabo's moving to Western Massachusetts, and you guys need to then restructure your visitation schedule. That then triggered the whole summer of 2022 litigation, where Judge Sullivan initially held Ms. Nereba in contempt of court, ordered her back, and she moved. She just unilaterally moved. And that, so we litigated all summer of last year, 2022, and ultimately what happened then was the court heard motions. Ms. Nedrabo then brought a motion to modify the visitation schedule. We brought a motion to enforce Judge Conley's visitation order. That then led to the two orders that are the subject of this appeal. Judge Sullivan issued an order in September of 2022 and then a follow-up order in February of 2023. And what she basically did was she analyzed this case not in terms of the relocation factors under 518.175, but she analyzed it as a modification of custody under 518.18. That's the crux of our two legal issues. And again, as I said at the outset, Your Honors, it's a de novo review because of that, that it's a legal interpretation of a statute. And let me kind of highlight for this. This thing is, it comes down to, in my opinion, a rather poorly drafted statute. 257C is something we've been grappling with since it was enacted in 2002. And the very first issue...
Mr. Deeble, can I ask you about that? I think the phrase you used, you're asking us to find 257C02A as ambiguous.
Yes.
Right? I'm having a hard time reading ambiguity into it, though. It references, of course, the key phrase that everybody's talking about is chapters 518. I'll ignore the other ones for now.
Yep.
Apply to third party and de facto custody proceedings. That little snippet, at least speaking personally, at least, it seems unambiguous to me to apply to custody proceedings, which everybody agrees is not no longer the case here since your client lost the third party to custody. So how would we read ambiguity into that? And I realize your argument might be poorly worded, but they have a right to poorly word things, of course. That's why we're all in business, I suppose.
But
that doesn't necessarily make it ambiguous, does it?
Well, I think I didn't think it was ambiguous either. I mean, my sense was that I don't know why, you know, all of Chapter 518 wouldn't apply unless it's explicitly provided that it doesn't. And what the language is, I think, that causes the ambiguity is it says, it basically doesn't define, it says applies to third party and de facto custody proceedings. Well, does third party modify custody proceedings, or is third party a catch-all phrase for custody and visitation? I think you could construe it either way, and I think if you construe it that third party is the broader term that encompasses both custody and visitation, because remember 257C encompasses both custody proceedings and visitation, and they're treated differently in terms of modification criteria across the spectrum of family law statutes. So that, I think, was, and if you look at Judge Sullivan's analysis, it's directly contrary to ours. She takes the very narrow construction of this particular part of it and says it only applies to custody cases. And if we're talking about visitation, as we are in this case, then it's a different standard. And to me, that doesn't make any sense, because I don't know why, unless they explicitly say this provision in 257C is not covered by 518, I don't know why you wouldn't apply it. And to give you a little more context in this case, why this sort of rankles my clients and I, is during the course of this litigation, one of the issues that came up was paying for Ms. Nadrabo's attorney's fees, whether my clients should pay for it, which they actually agreed to do, a couple $100,000 worth. And basically, there's no reference to attorney's fees in 257C, but Judge Conley said, well, I'm going to look to 518.14, which provides for need-based attorney's fees, which we accepted. My clients paid for it. So we're going to apply that construction in this case to the attorney's fees, but then we're going to take a very narrow construction of what standard applies to a visitation relocation, which is what this was. And then when we get to the analysis that Judge Sullivan applied to what standard does apply, she goes to 257C.06 and then applies a very expansive interpretation. 257.06 deals with custody modification. It says custody modifications. There's no ambiguity on that one. And it says custody will be analyzed under 518.18, which is the custody modification standard. And then she applies that criteria to a visitation issue when there is separate visitation.
I'm sorry, just to clarify your point on 257C.06, you say the judge used an expansive,
yeah.
But didn't the judge just literally read the second half of that sentence, govern modification of an order under this chapter, and she explained or analyzed in her order, an order was the most recent visitation order, therefore we apply 518.18.
Well, I think if you look at the language of 06, it says modification of a custody order, govern an order under this chapter. I would assume, why would that not apply to a custody order, that second part of the language?
In that sense, isn't that referring to 518.18, which indeed that's what that
Yeah, that's, and that's what she applied. But again, I'm puzzled as to why you would apply a custody. The criteria for modifying custody are very different from parenting time.
Doesn't that get us back to you're puzzled by the legislature, which is perhaps not an exception, more the rule oftentimes when we're reading some of these things, but that's different than our rules of interpretation, isn't it? So we're reviewing Judge Sullivan's review of that sentence, and while it may not make sense to any of us, the sentence says what it says, don't we just apply with the sentence? That's what the judge did, right?
I think you have to also step back and say, well, what is the issue that is here being considered for modification?
Well,
and
it's an order, though, right?
Yes,
this visitation, that's the only reason I'm asking is that, too, seems unambiguous. Would you agree that sentence, at least, that way?
Yeah, I think it is unambiguous. I think it applies to custody orders. And, you know, look, we put some legislative history in our analysis, too. And remember where this statute came from back in 2002. The first seven sections are completely new. There was glimmers of these things throughout, 518 and 257, but there was never a third-party custody statute standalone. The section on visitation, the 0.08 section, was in 257, and it was simply moved over. And I think, you know, if you accept our view that there's some ambiguity here, and then that then lets you look into legislative intent, which we did in our analysis, I think you then have to sort of think, well, so if we're going to look at these provisions in 518 and 257C and figure out what applies to what issues, it has to make some sense in terms of the whole thing fitting together in a logical, coherent whole. And that's where I think we're at, what we're asking this court to do is to look at this and to try to figure out when you've got a relocate. I mean, clearly there was no custody granted to my clients. It was simply visitation. And if you look at Judge Conley's original order, he was pretty clear that this will not be modified except by agreement of the parties or motion order of the court, which again is the criteria for a relocation issue. And I think if you also look at the language in 518, and Judge Sullivan acknowledges this, and I think we all do, is when these statutes get added, nobody is completely consistent. I mean, you go back and forth and you look at, there are still, there are the best interest factors are found in 257C and 518. 518 was modified several times, and I think the legislature forgot to go back and modify 257C because they're different sets of best interest factors. And, so you have to look at that. And here, I think what happened, if you look at the relocation provisions of 518.175, they refer to both parents and persons, which would suggest that 518.175 also applies to third parties, not just parents.
But how do you get around, I mean, the very plain language in subdivision 3 that references the parent?
Are you to which subdivision 3 of which statute? Of 175?
Of 518.175. Which, well, is where you'd like us to be, but
yes.
how do we get around the language in that subdivision, which, well, applies to the parent?
I think, Your Honor, again, so 518 is a divorce statute, which deals with disputes between parents. 257 has the custody and parenting disputes between unmarried parents, and then 257C deals with the third party issue. And neither 257 nor 257C have a provision that says how you modify or how you deal with relocations. But relocations, when they happen, whether they're in any of those three contexts, sort of raise the same issue. You're going to disrupt the existing visitation schedule or parenting time schedule. And I think if you look at the language in 518.175, just read, the heading says parents. It refers to that. But then when you go down to the 8 factors, some refer to parents, some refer to persons, and some say nothing. That would suggest to me that at least when that statute was initially enacted, it was designed to cover all of these circumstances. And the fact that 257C then by cross-reference refers to everything in 518 applies here unless it's explicitly excluded, I don't see that exclusion anywhere in 257C. And I don't know what criteria you would otherwise apply. And the fact that you're applying the wrong criteria, this case illustrates what can go wrong if you apply it. I mean, here we're applying an endangerment custody standard to a visitation order. And I think the upshot of this, and I see my time is out, is, yeah, I'm very concerned about the public policy implications of this decision, in that now a third party...
And maybe you can address those in your rebuttal argument.
I will do
Thank
that.
You. Here.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is John Gunderson, and I represent the respondent, Nina Nedribo, and she is the mother of the minor child, Maria, and she's 7 years old. Mother has sole legal and sole physical custody of Maria. And I think I'll start with Judge Slider's comment that the custody case has been litigated ad nauseum. There have been some 20 hearings in this case, 250 filings. All of the issues, all of the facts were extensively litigated in the district court. And the first thing that the district court did when it denied the motion for custody is it recognized the fundamental constitutional rights of a parent over the care, custody, and control of her child. That's always the beginning of the analysis, and that's why Judge Connolly started there. And as this court is aware, whenever the court, this court or the Supreme Court of Minnesota addresses 257C, it addresses the constitutional rights of the parents. And just a brief review of some of those cases. ALR in 2013, very recently, the fundamental rights of the parents are incorporated into Chapter 257C. So everything we do today must be done in the context of recognition of those constitutional rights. And the statutory framework must be analyzed in that context. Look at the Suhu case in 2007. Our Supreme Court, again, recognized those fundamental rights. They are more precious than any property right. And the interesting thing about Suhu is that it looked at 257C.08, grandparent visitation. It struck down Subdivision 7. Why did it strike down Subdivision 7? Because it was unconstitutional, because it placed too much burden on the parent. So again, the court is always going to recognize those constitutional rights in construing 257C.
What you're kind of arguing now seems to go to the first order, where the Judge Connolly did follow the statute carefully,
right,
and didn't grant custody.
Right.
But on the other hand, certainly I think robust is a fair description here, where it seems like you have an ideal involvement of grandparents to the extent of flying over to Norway and helping out. So I want to jump to 257C06, because
yes,
I understand how the judge applied 518.188, which is one of the argued errors here. The procedure in section 518.18 for modification of custody order also govern modification of an order under this chapter. And here's where I'll, Mr. Diebele's point makes some pretty good sense. On its face, we can maybe say with some confidence, I'm not sure the legislature fully understood they're also dealing with visitation under the statute. Would you agree that at a minimum, and you can see it in the judge's order, trying to apply the custody endangerment modification standard to a visitation modification is a square peg, round hole kind of a scenario. And you could see it when it got to the endangerment issue, because no one was alleging endangerment anywhere, and yet, so at a minimum, would you agree that application of 518.18 to this particular motion to modify parenting time is an odd fit?
I do agree, Your Honor. That is the odd thing about this case, is
so
why did the legislature in 2002, well, there was no modification provision in 257C, so in some effort to fix it, I guess they enacted 257C.06, and they said, well, why don't you look to 518.18? But I do want to be very clear with a point you picked up earlier, is that 257C.06 refers specifically to 518.18. It does cause an issue with the endangerment, but it does not refer to the parenting time statute, of course, 518.175. There's no question about that. It does not refer to that. And also, I want to go back and emphasize that this court has repeatedly made a very, very clear distinction between grandparent visitation and parenting time. There's no question about that. Even going back to the CDGD case in 2011, the court recognized a clear distinction between parenting time for parents and grandparent visitation. And then subsequently, the legislature, of course, amended 518.175 and all of 518, removed the word visitation when it was referring to parental visitation, replaced it with parenting time, and then it went a step further, and the grandparent provision under 518.175 subdivision 7 was completely removed from that statute, renumbered into another subdivision, 518.1752. So I do agree, Your Honor, that the modification issue is tricky. And the argument could be made that the endangerment standard is probably not the right standard to use when you're looking at visitation modification. Because if you look at all of the way the statutes are constructed, you look at all of our cases which clearly distinguish between parenting time and visitation, why then did you apply endangerment standard? I don't know if that's the key issue in this case, by the way, because, and this is the very end of my argument, is that that's an abuse of discretion. So we're on a, you know, if you apply the statutes properly and we're talking about whether endangerment applies, that's not really the issue in this case. I mean, ultimately, the issue in this case is, did the court properly rule that 518.175, which specifically and clearly refers to parenting time, does that apply to grandparent visitation? And that's a very hard hurdle for the appellant to climb here, to somehow say that that statute, parenting time, this court's ruling, specifically holding that parenting time is different than visitation, that is a very difficult argument to make that that statute somehow applies to grandparent visitation. And in fact, and I'm jumping around on my arguments, Your Honor, to focus on these issues, but if you turn to this court's decision in the Warmuth case in 2008, I mean, that the court specifically clearly said that, well, let's look at the language of the statute, let's apply the rules of construction. The statute refers to a parent with parenting time. Quite plainly, it doesn't refer to grandparent visitation, and the grandparent with visitation doesn't apply. And the court has to go back and construe these statutes under the plain language of the statutes. I mean, going back to the rules of construction, 645.08, which of course the court is familiar with, the canon of construction, we have to begin there. We have to use that canon, which says words and phrases are construed according to their common and approved usage. So we have to look at the word parenting time and apply that to its proper usage, and we have to look at the word visitation according to its usage, which is now completely set aside from parenting time. And the court also must follow 645.16. When the words of the law in their application are clear and free from ambiguity, the letter of the law must be followed. So there really is no room for any kind of veering away from the plain language of the statute and somehow ignoring the plain language or creating ambiguity, which really isn't there, and then inserting legislative history or intent. We can't go down that road because we're simply looking at the construction of the statute, and that's what the court in the Warmuth case did. And even going back as far as the Foster case, even before these statutes were amended to clarify the parenting time and the visitation, the court in that case looked at the difference between parenting time and visitation. And again, the court said there's a clear distinction. And again, this is all done under the umbrella of protecting the fundamental rights of the parent. And the fundamental right of a parent is to live where they want to live. So by somehow not following the language of the statute, creating ambiguity where no ambiguity exists, and then somehow putting visitation into the framework of the parenting time, that simply doesn't work. It's not according to the plain language of the statute. It is not consistent with the fundamental rights of the parents. It's not consistent with a line of cases from this court which carefully construe 257C, which distinguish between parenting time and visitation repeatedly, and which applies the statutory construction to align these statutes as they're written. And the other issue that I'll just go back to again that Your Honor, Judge Slider raised, is that even if that modification provision is a little different and it doesn't quite fit, and maybe there's some uncomfortableness there, ultimately, the district court in this case, now we switch to an abuse of discretion standard, because the district court is applying a modification, and particularly in that context, this court gives great, great deference to a district court under modification. It's almost a heightened abuse of discretion. And the case I cited in my brief is there's scant, if any, room for this court to second guess the district court when it's modifying custody. And in this case, the district court, of course, made very, very careful and detailed findings. Judge Sullivan knew this case was going to be appealed. She followed the statutory factors for modification. They're a little different than 257C, but they're not much different. I do acknowledge what counsel indicated, that 257C does have best interests, and they have not been modified to fit 518, but they're awfully close. And again, the district court has broad discretion to make those findings. The district court considered all of the appellant's arguments, and some of those arguments, quite frankly, were a repeat of the litigation in the district court. They were focusing on mental health, safety of the child. Again, those issues were already litigated. So the court then has to shift its focus to focus on what do we do now within the context of a grandparent visitation order. And I think the district court can do that, even if it's not perfect and you're following 518.18. The district court can still understand that this is a grandparent visitation order. It's not a parent. The court can make that distinction and adjust its analysis to comply with the grandparent visitation and make it appropriate and still follow the statute 257C, which says limited grandparent visitation, recognizing the constitutional rights of the parent, and understanding that the modification has to fit those circumstances. And that's the district court's job, is to look at all the facts. And the district court did that here. And it would be very, very difficult, I think, for this court to go back and second guess or rule that it was an abuse of discretion for the district court to apply the modification provision. And again, I will go back, even though it's not perfect, the new statute for modification does very clearly say 518.18, use the procedures and the provisions in there to modify grandparent visitation. It does not say use the relocation provisions or somehow interfere with the parental rights of the parent that are governed by the Constitution. So my time is almost up, and I think that's all I have, Your Honor. I would ask the court to affirm the district court in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to just start by noting we don't dispute any of the constitutional analysis that Mr. Gunderson presents, but the constitutional analysis was done at the trial court, the first hearing in the trial, where the judge ruled against us on the custody request, but then issued this robust visitation order. And so I think Troxel and those lines of cases are really not applicable to where we're at now. This is a statutory construction case. And what I'm troubled by is why would we treat a grandparent visitation order differently than any other visitation order, whether it's between a divorcing couple, whether it's an unmarried couple?
Isn't the rationale exactly what you just agreed with, the constitutional rights of parents?
That is when you're asking for the order to be issued. The first you know, whether the court's going to issue an order or not for visitation, what is it going to look like? That's where you do the constitutional analysis. But once the court issues the order, you're asking, it's going to be a slippery slope. If any parent who's unhappy about a grandparent or other third-party visitation order can simply move to another state and said, okay, order now is voided by my actions because I've made it so untenable. That's what this case suggests can happen. And I don't know why the court would countenance that kind of an approach when clearly Judge Conley, in his own order, issuing the order, said, this order is not to be modified except by agreement of the parties or an order of the court. Okay, how do you get an order of the court in one of these cases? You bring a request if you want to change it, and if you're moving to another state, the logic escapes me as to why you wouldn't apply relocation analysis to that. What is the difference, whether it's relocation or, you know, just moving, changing it within the state? You still apply the criteria that would be in 518 if there's no criteria in 257C, which there is not with regard to the visitation section.
Mr. Deeply, to follow up with that and maybe the last comment that Mr. Gunderson made, even if we were to agree that there was some error in which statute to apply, we're all kind of conceding there's three different statutes, but best interest is the main focus, and the district court seemed to thoroughly analyze the best interest factors under 518.17. Mm-hmm. So how would we find, in any event, clear error or an abuse of discretion in the ultimate conclusion? It's pretty obvious that the judge really looked at all the details that we've all been talking about in the litigation and in years past perhaps brought up.
But I think you have to get to the issue of whether she applied the proper standard or not, and that then gets you back to her statutory analysis.
But that's what I'm getting at. They all involve best interests, and as Mr. Gunderson points out, even the 518.175, the move, eight factors have some deviations, but not great deviations what's inherent in 518.175.
I would disagree with you a little bit on that, Your Honor, okay. Because I think those eight factors are quite different. I mean, there's a reason there's a separate statute that deals with relocation. We've got separate case law that deals with relocation. You have to look at what's the motive for the person who's moving, what's going to be the impact on the child by that move. All of that is absent from here because of the factors that she applied. And we go through in our brief what we would have argued on those eight factors had that been the criteria that she applied. And so I think you get a very different result. Plus, the burden is heavier, too. Because, the Wormuth case that Mr. Gunderson applies is a good example of this. In that case, the parent indicated in the trial, looking at the third-party custody and visitation, that he wanted to move. And the court says, well, okay, that's a different issue. We can't stop you from... third party can't stop you from moving, we'll issue the final order. That's a different situation than if you've got a final visitation order, a third party visitation, or as we have here, and then the parent decides they want to move. That then triggers 518.175 to apply and the different criteria that get applied. And that's the problem, I think, with the analysis here when we go back to these constitutional issues. Well, that's not applicable here because that ship's already left. And now we're looking at a relocation, a classic relocation case where there's a permanent visitation order in place, and you've got a parent who simply says, I don't want this, I don't want my mother to have access to the child. I'm going to move out to Western Massachusetts. She didn't commit at the trial. We kept asking her, are you going to move? Do you still want to move? The judge had stopped her in her tracks, if you recall. So that was a big issue in the trial. And no, she was perfectly comfortable in this very secure arrangement that Judge Conley premised his visitation order on. And she wasn't happy with that, and she started down the appeal process and then dropped that and said, no, I'm just going to move instead. That'll be an easier result is probably what her thinking was, and here we are. And this is going to be the precedent now. If any parent is unhappy enough with the third party, whether it's a grandparent, an aunt, or an uncle, they might say, I'm just going to move to Wisconsin. They don't have to move as dramatically as they did here, but that'll be a way to thwart that order. That can't be what the legislature intended with this. And I would say that visitation statute was tacked on at the end. That the legislative history we provided clearly suggests that. Lots of thought went into those first seven sections of 257C to make it a custody thing that complied with Troxel, which came down 2 years before the statute was amended. But the add-on, the visitation was just added on, not a lot of careful thought. And so I think that's why it's ambiguous as to whether those preliminary portions of 257C were meant to encompass all the 518 relocation factors. I think they would, as a matter of just if you do your statutory construction, what was the intent, what was the purpose, what are the public policy ramifications of this? I think Judge Sullivan got it wrong. We're asking this court to reverse that decision, order the child back to Minnesota, and then have an evidentiary hearing on the relocation factors. Maybe she reached the same result. I don't know. But those factors are different, and they needed to be considered as a relocation rather than a custody modification under the endangerment standard. And that's the legal problem, and that's the de novo standard of review that you have to look at that and see if she got it right. But I don't have anything else unless you had questions.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. They're very helpful. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame.